In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about family law and how it does, or in many cases does not, respond to the changing structure of the family in this country. And our guest for the program is Mary Shanley. She's professor of political science at Vassar College, and we'll talk about some of the issues that she raises in her book titled Making Babies, Making Families, and this subtitle, What Matters Most in an Age of Reproductive Technologies, Surrogacy, Adoption, and Same-Sex and Unwed Parents, suggesting some of the complexities now that we have to deal with. Beacon Press is the publisher. Came out a little while. Well, actually, today is the official publication date of the book. So if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We ask just the people try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here you want to call and join the conversation, you're welcome to do that. Professor Shanley, hello.
How do you do?
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
I appreciate it. Was there something in particular that led you into investigating and thinking about writing about this particular this area?
My previous work had been on family law, but on marriage law. My first book was on marriage reform law in Victorian England. Again, I was interested in the themes of the relationship between individuals and family relationship and those relationships and state control. And when I finished that book, I had to make a decision as to whether to keep working on Victorian England and the topics there or on issues concerning the family. And I realized after some introspection that my real interest was in families. And so at that point, I decided to take up not just marriage, but questions of creating families with children and cementing the relationships between parents and children. And the thing compellingly interesting about that was what was going on in my own country in my own time. And so that led to this book.
Yeah, and in part, I guess it is a reflection of your own experience because you have two adopted children.
Absolutely. We have adopted children. They were born, both of them, in Bogota, Colombia, and we made two trips to Bogota to adopt them. This, of course, increased my interest in adoption, but I also was interested in seeing the links between our experience and that of people who have formed families biologically. One of the things the book tries to do is to link these areas.
I think that the issue of the family and what's happening to the family and the fact that we now have families that one might call non-traditional, I'm going to put that in quotes, is something that concerns people now, and it's an issue that seems to have been boiling now for maybe a decade or two. And some people, I suppose, might think that this crisis, if you want to label it a crisis of the family, is something of recent vintage. I guess I was interested in thinking about this and in your observations that, in fact, it may not, the kinds of changes we've seen may not be all that new, and that the move away from the idea of a family as a strictly biological entity, some would argue, really starts in the mid-1800s with the creation of legal adoption.
Yes, and of course before 1850, which is when we begin to have statutes in the United States allowing legal adoption, children had been raised by people other than their biological parents, both through, as you know, during the colonial period, extensive apprenticeship arrangements where children would leave home to live with other families who would basically raise them. Not that that severed the ties to the biological parents, but it did create a fluidity in family forms. And in addition to that, if parents died frequently, other members of the family would take them in a form that we would call adoption, but it wasn't legal. What was new about the form of legal adoption was the creating of permanent and indissoluble ties between adults and non-biologically related children.
And at the same time, though, it seems that one thing that one in an aspect, or more than one aspect, in which this has changed relatively recently, is that even though there was this provision for forming this family of elements that were not biologically related, and that's not really a new idea, we at the same time it seems that we were pretending, in a sense, as if that this really wasn't true because of the way we handled adoptions, and we tried to, as much as possible, to place children with parents that were similar. And the fact that the records were closed, this, it all seemed to go to this idea that we were, what we were going to do is we were going to put together this family, and then we were going to pretend that they were, that they, in fact, they were biologically related when they really weren't.
Yes, you go to the heart of one of the things that I try to discuss in the book. Your description is, I think, exactly right, and I won't add to it, except to say that this is one of the changes that comes about, I would say, in the latter half of the 20th century, when one in the United States after the 1960s, there begin to be adoption across racial lines. The growth in the last decade of international adoptions, where, again, children have different racial features than their parents, has also meant that that notion of replicating the biological family, what I call, I think you repeated the phrase, the as-if family, mm-hmm. that these children are as if they had been born to these specific parents, that certainly has changed in the world of adoption. It also is the case, to take up another, just to mention another topic I cover in the book, that with the new reproductive technologies, such as sperm and ovum donation, initially those also were to create as-if families. These children were not the biological children of both parents, but no one knew that, and it appeared as if they were those children. Now, with these new reproductive technologies being used by some single persons and by some gay and lesbian couples, it's very clear that the child is not the biological offspring solely of the person or persons who are raising the child. This is a tremendous change, I think, in the latter quarter of the 20th century.
Yeah, we have moved away from the notion almost that a child placed for adoption essentially was an orphan. We acted as if this child had no parents, when in most cases, the child did.
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that I call for in the book, or discuss in the book, is that it seems to me that in almost all cases, the greatest amount of information and the greatest amount of truth that can be disseminated is the most appropriate, not necessarily when the child is very young, but I do argue, as you know, having read the book, in the book, for unsealed records, arguing that anyone upon reaching adulthood should have access to accurate information about their biological forebears or progenitors. This doesn't lead, it seems to me, to confusion about who the social parents and the legal parents are, in cases even of open adoption, where biological parents and social parents know one another and sometimes visit during the course of the child's growing up. There is no confusion about who is the legal parent, who is the social parent of the child. Those are the adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. And I'm arguing that I think both individuals and society can deal with this greater complexity without enormous confusion, and that that's a good thing.
Yeah, it seems that in all of these various cases, and we'll go on and talk about some other issues that maybe even get more complicated, mm-hmm. what it seems that what you're trying to do, or what you're advocating the law tried to do, is steer something of a mid-course between extreme positions, one on the one hand saying that what parenting is all about is a biological relationship, the other would be to say, no, it's really about a caretaking relationship, and that our decisions about who has rights and what kind of rights they have follow from one or the other. In a sense that you're saying we've got to take all of that into consideration.
Yes, that's exactly right. We don't simply say we don't say, for example, that at the time of birth, to take an extreme, all children are up for grabs. That is, that the state now will decide who will best raise this child, or what households in this country are best equipped to raise children, and take children and put them with what somebody judges to be the best possible caregiver. So that would be a very extreme position of saying it's the provision of care, not biology, which should govern parenting. The other extreme, of course, as you say, is whoever it is that's the biological parent should have parental rights. And it seems to me it's clear in our practices in this society that we accept neither of these extremes. What becomes very tricky is, if we don't take either extreme, how do we draw the lines and make the nuanced judgments in those cases which fall in between? And that's what becomes, it seems to me, very difficult to do. But again, I have confidence that it can be done.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mary Shanley. She's professor of political science at Vassar College, and the book that we're talking about here in which she explores these issues is titled Making Babies, Making Families. It's published by the Beacon Press, and questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks, toll-free 800-222-9455. How common now is open adoption?
You know, I have to confess that I don't know the percentage of adoptions which are conducted as open adoptions. They are, however, not at all uncommon. And more than that, many states now have adopted unsealed records. Again, I don't know the exact proportion of states which have said that when a child reaches the age of majority, usually that's 18, if they want to, they can find out who their biological parents are. Even more states have what are known as adoption registries. These seem to be accepted very broadly, and that is when both the biological parent and the adopted child contact the adoption agency or the state. They are then given ways of making contact with one another. So there are a variety of things, from open adoption, where the adoptive and the biological parents actually know one another and meet one another prior to the adoption, to open adoption registries, where with mutual consent, contact can be made after the child reaches adulthood, to unsealed records, which allow an adult adoptee access to those original birth records.
I guess the important point is that the kind of openness that we see now, it is much more than it used to be, and it seems to be an idea that is growing in its acceptance.
Yes, absolutely. This was not known prior to the 1960s. There were very few cases of this taking place. So this is one of those great changes that you mentioned, and one that I think, again, we need to develop practices and people need to become experienced with. But so far, it has, by and large, I think, proven to be an experiment which has been successful, although there have been some unfortunate instances.
This, and talk about another sort of situation again that makes it very difficult, or at least poses this difficult question of how do we decide parental rights, mm-hmm. and how do we negotiate this business of biological connection and caregiving? It's the kind of case, we've seen a couple of them, and there was one very controversial case that got national coverage here in the state of Illinois, and I'm thinking about the case of Baby Richard. Mm-hmm. This case where we had a couple conceived a child. That's to make the proverbial long story short, the woman placed the child for adoption without notifying the father. And when the father found out, he moved to, he said, look, this child is mine. I never consented to this, and moved to reverse the adoption or to intervene. The whole process took a very long time, and the upshot was that here a child that had been placed with adopted parents and had lived with them for a couple of years was eventually taken away from them. I'm sure it was a very traumatic experience for everybody concerned, and it went all the way to the Illinois State Supreme Court, and again got a lot of attention and was very controversial, and maybe one of the reasons that the man who was the Chief Justice at the time, Judge Heupel, eventually resigned his position. He's still in the court, but he's not the Chief Justice anymore. So, again, coming down to this very sort of difficult question about for fathers, when we have couples here who are not married, what should we say about the rights of a biological father? particularly one that hasn't really in any other way been involved with this child.
Well, one of the things that that I talk about in the book is this question of father's rights and biological father's rights. The kinds of cases that I find very the Baby Richard case in Illinois was wrenching, and I'll say something about that in just a moment. To take a kind of less complicated, to my mind, cases than that, there are sometimes fathers who, several months after a child has been born, find out about its existence and then insist that they be considered as the legal custodial parent, even though the child has been placed with adoption and has lived with adoptive parents for, can be 4, 5, 6 months. Those cases, it seems to me, where the biological father has not been living with the mother, has not known in some cases of the pregnancy, has not known the child has been born, but learns after the fact that offspring exist and then asks for parental rights. In those cases, I am unsympathetic to the unwed father's plea because of my concern that legal parental rights be linked to caregiving. There has been no caregiving in those cases, and the claim is simply genetics gives me parental rights. I resist that argument. In a case like Baby Richard in Illinois, insofar as I understand it, and you need to correct me if I don't, it's much more complicated because the biological father had, in fact, been living with the mother for many months. They had shared an apartment. They, in fact, had made plans for the child's birth. They had arranged with a hospital for a birth, and then the father left the country to go back to Central Europe where he was from. During his absence, the baby was born. The relatives told the mother that he had been married abroad. She felt traumatized and basically didn't want to see him when he returned and told him that the baby had died. He remained persistent and then found out that the baby was alive, had been placed for adoption, and sued for parental rights. There, it seems to me, laws can make a great deal of difference. One of the things that you want to establish in a law is that for an unwed father to have a claim to seek custody, he needs to have provided care. But it seems to me that that care, the provision of care, doesn't simply mean to the need not only be to the child after it's born, but to the mother when she is pregnant, when she is bearing the child. One of the things I think we can do, we often think of pregnant women as providing care to the child during the time of gestation. And we need to think, well, what are the analogs to that care that men provide even during a time of pregnancy? One is to support the mother financially. Another is to take responsibility for paying medical expenses. Another is to hold himself out as the father-to-be. These things would give a man standing, if you will, to go into court and say, I, too, have been acting as a father publicly and from the moment I knew of the existence of this child. Had there been criteria like that in place in Illinois, it seems to me that all the parties to that controversy would have realized very early on that there were at least grounds for a hearing for the biological father. And the kind of keeping him away from the child would have been seen to be extremely risky and unlikely to succeed. Lawyers would have known not to counsel the adoptive parents in that way. I think there can be clarifications that can avoid some of these tragedies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it certainly a lot of people were very unhappy with the outcome of the people in the state were unhappy with the outcome. But fair to say that maybe really the issue was the fact that it took so long for a decision to be made. Maybe still people would have been unhappy with the outcome if it had happened when the baby was weeks or months old as opposed to years old. But the fact that the wheels of justice here ground so slow, right, that seemed to be an issue that and perhaps didn't get as much attention as just the, you know, the very traumatic circumstances when finally the Illinois State Supreme Court said that the baby should go to the biological parents.
I could not agree with you more. I am not myself an attorney. I am not involved in making I try to think about principles that should guide family law, but how the operations of courts work is something that I can't take any responsibility for. But it does seem to me that there's and that the public should insist that when cases of disputed adoption come before family courts, that they be treated expeditiously, that it is an absolute responsibility on the courts not to allow these cases to go on at the kind of length that case did, where the final placement of the child is uncertain, because only trauma to the child can come out of such cases if the child is removed from the only home it is known. As you know, there was a similar case that involved an Iowa couple and a couple in Michigan, was known as the Baby Jessica case. And again, similarly, there was a dispute about jurisdiction in that case between Iowa and the other state, and it dragged on for years. It seems to me, again, I don't know how to do this, I'm not involved in the mechanics of the courts, but that the best minds in our country should be working on ways of figuring out how the courts can expedite such cases so that they don't take so long.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly would expect that other states, looking at the experiences, that experience here in Illinois and others, would say, we don't want this to happen in our state. But it sounds as if if one asks the question, have other states learned from this experience and made changes in their law? I'm not sure what the answer to that question would be.
I think that there hasn't been, I can't answer that. There are 50 jurisdictions in the United States, and again, I don't practice family law, and so don't know exactly what the stipulations in each state are. But I do think that states can clarify these questions of when is it that we will regard an unwed father as having established that he has been a care provider, that is, that those stipulations could be made clearer in state statutes. And then there's the whole separate question of court procedures, and that it seems, again, that states need to decide that they will have a presumption that such cases will move to the head of the queue and will be dealt with expeditiously whenever they arrive for the good of the child. Again, one of the things that I try to emphasize in the book is my feeling that my judgment that to sustain existing relationships is a fundamental ethical demand on individuals and then on policymaking bodies. That is, that relationships between parents and child should, whenever possible, be maintained and sustained and supported by both the law and the social practices of the society. So I take that as a very serious ethical responsibility. It's one of the reasons I argue for adopt a child being able to obtain information about birth parents. That is, that's a relationship, and one which should be sustained, not by day-to-day contact, but in the possibility of obtaining information about it. I think to rupture those fundamental human relationships is always a very difficult thing to do.
We're a little bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and I'd like to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Mary Shanley. She is professor of political science at Vassar College, and the issues that we're discussing here, she discusses at some length in her book, Making Babies, Making Families, What Matters Most in an Age of Reproductive Technologies, Surrogacy, Adoption, and Same-Sex and Unwed Parents. It's published by the Beacon Press and should be in bookstores now or soon if you'd like to look at it. And if you have questions, of course, you can call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. In the past, for couples that were having difficulty conceiving a baby, who wanted to have a baby that was at least partly theirs genetically, there for a long time there was the possibility of artificial insemination, either with sperm of the husband, if part of the issue was sperm quality, you could try to put together as much as you could and then use that, or you could use sperm that was donated. And that was something that had kind of been around for a while. But relatively recently, now we have the additional possibility of using donated eggs and having them fertilized in vitro and having that placed into the mom so she can carry that term. And I know that using the term donated, we have to put that in quotes because you point out that most cases here, we're talking about the sperm and the egg having been paid, something has been paid for them. So we're not exactly, in this country, we're not exactly talking about something that's donated. But here we get into, again, a number of issues. And one of the things that I found interesting is the fact in this country, apparently, this whole process is the, about the most unregulated that it is any place in the world, or at least in the developed world, and that you really make the argument strongly. One thing you argue strongly against is paying for egg or sperm. Why is it that you would like to see that done away with?
I do argue strongly against it. The practice is one of the things that I point out in the book, and this was actually, if I can just backtrack a little bit, this was very interesting to me as I began studying this issue of creating families through the new reproductive technologies, is that how it has simply evolved through activities of people, as you say, totally unregulated or without a lot of forethought. People act, and then the law kind of scrambles to play catch-up ball. And since sperm donation, as you say, was the easier, the more easily obtained genetic material, just token payment was made, usually to sperm donors, a very minor amount of money exchanged hands. And people didn't think a great deal about that. It didn't seem as if this was a kind of trafficking in genetic material. It seemed reasonable to give a small amount to somebody who had contributed this genetic material. But with ovum donation, as we call it, the procedure, of course, is much, much more complicated. It involves, first of all, injections of hormones into both the woman whose eggs are going to be harvested, that is collected. Is given hormones so that she'll produce many eggs, and so it is known exactly when ovulation will take place. And then by aspiration, but a kind of minor surgery, those are removed from her body. Similarly, the woman who's to receive the embryo created by in vitro fertilization also receives hormones so that she will be at the same point in her cycle as the donor. This is a complicated medical procedure, and particularly given the stress on the body of the woman donating the eggs, significantly greater payment was given to her. But initially, that payment was thought to be for her pain, for the inconvenience that she went through, not only in the act of the surgery, but for the month preceding it where she underwent this hormone manipulation. It was thought she should receive a payment, and the payment was around, started out at $500 and went up to about $2,000 in the United States. But egg donors are hard to come by, and what has happened in recent years, I begin the chapter in my book that talks about this by talking about ads that have appeared in many college newspapers. Maybe they're in your listening area that they've appeared at the University of Illinois. I don't know, but they have been in many college newspapers offering $25,000 up to the highest that so far I think has been recorded, $50,000. For an egg donation from a young woman, and then follow stipulations as to what the characteristics of that donor shall be. Height, eye color, hair color, usually sometimes SAT scores, that is combined SAT scores of 1400, athletic ability, and so on. It's that practice of differential pricing and of allowing an unregulated and open market that I find objectionable, that somebody should be given $2,000 for the pain and inconvenience of donation if that's a standard fee for all donors, is something I don't particularly object to. It's the differential pricing and the bidding for donors that I think is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that essentially European countries have outlawed.
By and large, I speak about some. I have not done a universal survey of the practices in all countries, but England, for example, does not allow this differential pricing. New Zealand does not. Australia does not. France does not. So I do know that the practice, that the United States is the country in which the United States has the fewest regulations. It really has no regulations except internal ones in terms of the medical procedures. But it allows people to make whatever kinds of arrangements they want and that they can get someone else to agree to. That's an extreme of kind of individual entrepreneurship that I find unacceptable. At the same time that I'm trying to say it's okay to use some of these technologies, the other extreme is, of course, a very conservative, very traditional, we mustn't go down this road at all, only biological procreation in the traditional way is a legitimate way of founding families. Again, between those two extremes, it seems to me there are ways of thinking about the principles we want to embrace as we enter this fairly unknown territory.
Mm. And you're not necessarily saying that the idea of, say, if you're going to do this, that you would want to look for someone who would be genetically, you know, similar to your partner, that idea is not necessarily problematic, but it's the idea that you would say, I'll give you $20,000 or $50,000 above and beyond some kind of payment that would take care of the medical expenses and then perhaps some tokens.
Yes, exactly. No, there are a few people who have argued that the eggs or the sperm should not be classified according to any criteria, that if you want to use such genetic material, you should simply be the next in line and take whatever egg may be available. That is, there should be no matching of characteristics of race, of height, of ethnic background, of a cultural background. I don't take that position. It seems to me that the reasons that people turn to using assisted reproduction are so complex and have some fine and motives behind them that I'm not for that kind of randomization. I think that's not necessary. But it's when you get into this area of differential pricing for different characteristics, it seems to me you do two things. You give the message to children that certain children have been worth more, that certain characteristics, again, of height, of hair color, of race, and so on, of intelligence, are more valuable, and that were bought for more or bought for less. And you also are pricing the characteristics of adults, of the adults who have those, and saying you're of more value than someone else. We do that in differential pricing in the labor market. I have qualms about that, but I think it's very dangerous to move that to saying that certain kinds of genetic characteristics are worth more on the open market than others are.
We have some callers here to bring into the conversation. We'll start with first in line being Urbana in line one. Hello.
Yeah, along your last theme, people talk about designer babies and perhaps the creation of a separate caste of people growing out of the rich because they're the only ones that are going to be able to afford these high prices to select your babies. I don't know if you've thought about the long-term effects, but you might want to comment on that, but the reason I called was I was just curious if you knew 60 Minutes did a rerun of a previous show they had run last year, and they said that there's a case in California with a kid that had five parents, essentially. Somebody had donated the sperm, somebody donated the egg, and then they got a surrogate to carry the baby to term. And then, of course, the parents that adopted the kid, and apparently they were wealthy to pay for this whole thing. But I was just wondering they didn't mention it on 60 Minutes why they were in court, and I was just wondering if they were in a court for any kind of relevant reason. And I'll something you could talk about, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know exactly which case you're referring to, but people have said this, and this, you know, that it's now possible for a child to have five parents in exactly the way that you said, a sperm and egg donor, a surrogate, and then two what we call social or legal parents. And again, some people say this is outrageous. This strains all the traditional practices of Western society, and this needs to be stopped and outlawed. I don't think it's going to be stopped. There's no movement in this country to eliminate this. And the point that I'm trying to make in this book is what we need to do is think about what are the principles by which we might allow such families to be formed that don't simply say adults can do anything that they want. They can make whatever kinds of contracts they want, any kinds of agreements they want, and we as a society and as a state have nothing to say about that. Instead, what I'm trying to do is generate those principles that will allow us to make some judgments about what can and cannot be done. My guess is that if there was a legal case involving that kind of arrangement that you were just describing, that it probably had to do with the surrogate. That is, surrogates sometimes bear a child under a contractual arrangement with the people who want to become the legal parents, that they will surrender the child at birth to those parents. And then sometimes in the course of the pregnancy, change their mind. They realize that they have a greater ties to the fetus that they are bearing than they had anticipated having, and they indicate that they want to back out of the contract. I do discuss this in the book and argue that this should be treated more like adoption than it should like a business contract, and that the person who has borne the child, the woman who has borne the child, does in fact have a relationship with the child that gives her standing to go into court to contest custody with the biological father. This, of course, is not something that anyone would look forward to doing. One of the consequences of such a regulation, it seems to me, is it might cut down on the number of surrogacy arrangements in the United States, and I would not be sorry to see that happen. But that does not outlaw the practice, but it says there are values here of relationship which we will maintain, and those who enter into these agreements must realize that those are the consequences.
Hmm. Well, what to take some of the other parties in this hypothetical, the parties who donated the sperm and the egg, do they have any parental rights?
I don't think so. I think that it's such a tenuous relationship. After all, they are not like pregnancy. Pregnancy is a 9-month experience process that a woman experiences that she's conscious of, that she lives with, and where she can, we've seen women come forward to say, this actually has changed my understanding of what I was doing. The donating of sperm and eggs, there should be extensive counseling before that takes place, but it doesn't involve that same kind of relationship with a being that the pregnancy does. What I have argued, though, is that while I don't think those donors have rights, as you understood from what I was saying about adoption or one of the things, open adoption, I do think that the person created by donated genetic material should be able to obtain the identity of those donors again upon reaching adulthood. I simply think that that kind of openness of information is an important right that we could give to adults.
About 10 minutes left, a little bit less, actually. And then one more time, I'll introduce you to our guest. We're talking with Mary Shanley. She's professor of political science at Vassar College. And the book that explores these issues, if you'd like to look at it, is titled Making Babies, Making Families, published by Beacon Press. Next caller here in line is Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Yes, this has been the summer of weddings for me, and I've traveled to many larger cities than what I live in, which is not hard, but in these travels, I came across lots of free pregnancy testing in a lot of strip malls, and I asked myself, there's surely some reason for this. They're not giving this away free for something. Is it so they can find women that are willing to adopt the children, or what is this? Or have you ever seen it?
I have to confess that you're asking a question that I don't have an answer to. I haven't noticed this in the area of the country I live in, which is the Northeast.
That's what I noticed. I'd never noticed it before.
I don't know what this would be. Yeah. What this would be for?
I've seen it in Chicago, Indianapolis, and St. Louis now, and it seems, and not just one place is in each one of these cities, but several, and they're always in little strip malls. And they're
offering free pregnancy tests. Come in and find out if you're pregnant.
Exactly, free pregnancy test. Strange.
I wouldn't know. I mean, one would want to find out if those are linked to hospitals, whether there are clinics that are trying to do early intervention so that people get prenatal care, or whether it's trying to identify, as you say, unwed mothers who might be interested in relinquishing a child for adoption. That seems unlikely to me. The number of women relinquishing children for adoption is declining in the United, or has declined in the United States. But whether this is linked to some kind of, it could be a medical outreach,
yeah,
trying to do get people into early prenatal care, or you suggest it may be linked to some slightly shadier negotiation. I have no idea.
These strip malls didn't look like anything you'd want a professional place at. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry that I don't know more about the practice.
That's interesting. I guess my guess would be the explanation you suggest is that it's an effort to try to have women who identify pregnancy early so that then they will have prenatal care and not for some questionable ulterior motive, but I guess we just don't know.
I confess I don't, but maybe some other listener does and can help us with this, but this was new to me, not something that I have come across.
Well, we're coming down to about our last 4 or 5 minutes, and I guess by way of summing up, it sounds as if you're in part, what you're encouraging people to do is to think about how it is we deal with these things. And, of course, we know that they're already here. I guess we in this country sometimes have this problematic tendency to adopt technologies first and then think about them afterwards. And that's kind of what we've done with this. That is, these particularly reproductive technologies are here. It seems that we have, in many cases, the technology has leapt ahead of law and also perhaps some consensus on the issue.
That's exactly right. The technology has moved very rapidly ahead of anything that the law has thought of. And so one of the things is that as cases arise, judges are placed in a position of trying to decide often what are called these Solomonic dilemmas, where people come forward with claims where one feels empathy on both sides. What many of your listeners will remember, the Baby M case in New Jersey, which was the most publicized case of surrogacy in the United States. And it was heart-wrenching. One felt both for the parents who were expecting the child and also for the surrogate mother. The law, there was no statutory law governing this at all. It had to be decided by individual judges, and they scrambled to make these decisions. One of the things that I'm hoping to do with the book is to try to identify the kinds of principles that could guide both judges, but also, as you pointed out earlier in the program, state legislatures, to think what are the values that we really are wanting to protect as people form new kinds of families. As I say, I'm trying to tread a line and find a place between a very conservative and traditional position, which would say we shouldn't be allowing these new forms of configuration. We have to stop them. I think, as I say, that's impossible and also not particularly desirable. I think some of these ways of forming families are tremendously important. As you pointed out, I'm an adoptive parent myself. At the same time, I don't think that it simply should be left to ad hoc decisions of individuals to see what kinds of bargains they can strike in the world of either adoption or of reproductive technology. I think there are principles that we can explore together, hold to, and decide as a democratic society that are deeply ethical and that we don't abandon the ethical territory to a kind of chaotic free-for-all.
We're very short on time here. I have a couple of callers.
Sure.
I don't think I can get them both. We'll try to get at least one.
I'll try to be very brief.
In Urbana here, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was just going to comment on the pregnancy testing in strip malls. I think a lot of those are pro-life groups who are trying to head off abortions and offering counseling against that. Uh-huh. And that's the purpose of a lot of those places. And that's all.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good. Let's go here to another caller here. This is line 2 at Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I had the same comment.
All right.
The previous caller just did. I think they're pro-life, trying to intercept potential abortions.
All right.
Thanks.
Good enough. All right. Well, I think probably about this point that we have come to the end of the time, and we're going to have to say thanks. Professor Shanley, we appreciate you taking the time and talking with us this morning.
I very much appreciated talking to you and to all of your callers. It was a great pleasure.
Our guest, Mary Shanley, is professor of political science at Vassar College. And once again, if you're interested in reading the book that she's authored, it's titled Making Babies, Making Families. And the subtitle, it's a long one, What Matters Most in an Age of Reproductive Technologies, Surrogacy, Adoption, and Same-Sex and Unwed Parents. And the book is published by the Beacon Press.